Hello and welcome to the Finding Sacramento podcast. You're listening to episode number 42 with comic book creator and English professor Dan Bethel.
It's a bunch of nerds interrupting people who know what they're doing.
Hello, and welcome to the Finding Sacramento podcast. My name is Nathan Miller, and thank you for taking time out of your day to listen to my show. Today's episode is episode number 42 with comic book creator and English professor Dan Bethel. We chat about why obsession is natural, how a short stint in the video game industry stifled his artistic passion for drawing and how he found it again, why he loves teaching others the process of writing, how Dan shows up in his own comics, the birth of the Long John comic, and what Dan hopes the payoff will be when Long John is finished, the state of the comic book industry in Sacramento, and why he hopes that either through his comics or his teaching that he is ultimately given back to the world. If you're new to the show, be sure to check out past episodes of the show featuring local businesses like Bacon and Butter, South, One Speed Pizza, V. Miller Meats, Plant Foundry, Sac Brew Bike, Big Tree Comics, and more at FindingSacramento.com. Also, if you want to get new episodes of the Finding Sacramento podcast automatically each week, be sure to hit the subscribe button on whatever listening device you happen to be listening to the show with, whether that be iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, etc. Finally, if you like the show, please do me a huge favor and spread the word to other folks who might also like the show, or better yet, go out and support the 41 businesses that have been featured on this very podcast. Dan Bethel. This interview was wildly comfortable to me. Dan is a teacher. I'm a teacher. Dan is a creative. I'm a creative. And my previous podcast in a little town in North Carolina featured plenty of creative folks full of self-doubt that ultimately learned how to overcome that doubt by turning their doubt into art. And Mr. Bethel just happens to be one of those folks. He just happens to live in Sacramento. And it's always the ones with the most doubt that happen to be the most talented, and Mr. Bethel is also one of those folks. But he will probably ignore this compliment and focus on a tiny mistake he makes in this interview that follows instead. But that awkwardness and self-doubt is exactly what makes him a great storyteller. You heard me say it before, I am not a comic book guy. Long John, however, is a superb piece of work, not only in its storytelling, but man, the artwork in it is pretty kick-ass, too. The audio in this podcast is pretty crisp, but there is a few times in this podcast, for some reason, it sounds like we hit a bump in the road and it skips. The instances of that pretty much go away after the 20-minute mark, and for those that listen to the show at 1.5 speed, I'm not sure you will even notice, but I thought I would give you all a heads up. This interview was important for me as I've recently considered getting back into a few creative hobbies myself, and Dan's story of overcoming doubts is ultimately motivational, and I hope it is for you all as well. How many times can I say ultimately in an intro? Ladies and gentlemen, comic book creator and English professor and creator of Long John, the comic, Dan Bethel. What would you describe yourself as?
Oh, I'm a simultaneous English professor and comic book maker.
Okay.
Trying my best to not screw both things up, mm-hmm. You know?
You ready for the Midwest version of the pronunciation of your hometown?
Sure.
Yeah. Is it San Luis Obispo? Or
San Luis Obispo.
There you go.
If you want to be correct with the Spanish, yeah, it should be San Luis Obispo, but San Luis Obispo, San Luis.
I'm a University of Montana grad, so I had this Cal Poly football trip planned for like a year, and then my fiance's sisters threw a surprise vacation for my fiance, so I did not get a chance to go down there. So what's going on down there?
What's going on in San Luis? I don't know. It's been a while.
Yeah.
I was one of those situations where once I got to kind of a point, I couldn't wait to get out of there. But but my wife actually attended for a year at University of Montana.
Oh, cool.
As well, yeah, in the Wilderness and Civilization program.
Yeah. That's a big program up there.
She loved it. She loved it. But as far as San Luis Obispo is concerned, if you like surfing, if you like... surfing, basically. Mm-hmm. It's pretty close to the ocean, about a 15-minute drive.
Yeah.
It wasn't really kind of for me, at least that's where I am now at this point. You know, I guess there's one thing of being born and raised there, just kind of being, I want to see something else, be somewhere else. But I don't want to be mean and say there's no culture there. There's a culture there, but it's just very isolated, very... safe, very, very homogenous, you know, and I can kind of, I got my first taste of like real diversity when I moved away for a year to upstate New York. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this is, you know, other people aren't scary kind of stuff, you know? And it really, made me sort of crave interaction, crave, connection with people of a variety of lives. And that's why actually kind of jumping forward, being in Sacramento, it was, but for both my wife and I, it was completely just a temporary choice. We're like, okay, I'm here for her to get some experience with her job and for me to get my master's degree. And then we're going somewhere fun. And then we both kind of fell in love with the place. And for me, I know it's mostly interacting with students that don't have my background, that don't have my shared interests, that have different goals. And it's just so fascinating on an academic level, but just you know, warming to be able to be part of other people's lives, especially people that maybe in my hometown I would never have had a chance to meet. And so I've already kind of an idealistic person, but it just kind of pumps it up quite a bit to be like, oh, I can actually help people, right?
Well, and I think it allows you to tell stories better.
Oh, no doubt.
Because when I did stand up back in the day, I wasn't necessarily sure the jokes that I was telling on stage was kind of representative of the population that I was talking to. Because I grew up in a town with the graduating class was 27 students.
Oh, wow.
There was no diversity at all. Right. Small town, cornfields, et cetera. So I imagine interacting with a diverse population allows you to tell stories better. Is that
I would absolutely
something
agree.
You would agree with?
At least, to tell stories better. I think storytelling comes with practice, but it's also to make the stories themselves better. And just you know, when you come up with a new character, for example, don't just default to white dude.
Yeah,
you know, it's like let's actually make this an interesting to look at page or panel or whatnot, and that definitely I've seen pop up in my own work.
Mm-hmm. Why were you in your hometown? Your dad owned a surf shop, or what's going on?
No, I was. My dad was a university professor. He taught at Cal Poly, and he was a full professor of philosophy at Cal Poly. And my mom had a job there. Both my mom went to school there. My dad just happened to get a job there, and so it all kind of worked out. They're both from L.A. and just kind of found themselves up in San Luis. But so it's just they had jobs there. My mom was a correctional counselor at the local medium security prison, the California Men's Colony. Shout out, I guess. I don't know. But it was that's why I was there and kind of helped shape my worldview, especially of that city, because they were transplants. And San Luis has really become a place where white retirees go to this point on the West Coast. And so they had fallen in love with it, especially coming from the, the urban growth of Los Angeles. And especially my dad grew up in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s. And so he wanted a bit of the quaintness back, I guess, and kind of fell in love with San Luis Obispo. And so I think also them wanting to be nowhere else also kind of shaped my view of the city in a sense. I'm like, oh, maybe I want to be somewhere else. Because I didn't leave for a while, I don't think. I was 21 when I first moved away and found, I'm like, oh, I don't have to stay home.
Right.
But
any interest in dad's career or mom's career growing up?
Well, aside from teaching, no. Growing up with a philosophy professor is an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom's career, it's interesting. I think there are aspects of both their professions that have bled over into what I do and how I do it. Like my mom was a counselor. She was always into listening and talking things out and understanding perspectives. And I know I bring that to the classroom, no doubt. And my dad is not the philosophy professor of long hair and Birkenstocks and stuff like that. He's a straight-laced, kind of conservative, logician, kind of classical philosophy kind of stuff. And so just having that inquisitive, that problem-posing mind, no doubt, which led to much frustration as a child for me, definitely fueled how I approach the classroom and how I get students to think for themselves rather than just me telling them what to think or what to do, right?
Well, that's better than I grew up with a couple of philosophy friends that now have their PhDs in philosophy, and all they post about is like 90 problems a day, and that just seems anxiety ridden. But that doesn't sound like your dad. So.
No, I mean he's got anxieties, no doubt. But I think if anything, I got from him, he's just very quiet and contemplative. Contemplative. There you go. Just very self-reflective in that regard. And his specialty in philosophy was specifically philosophy of the mind, which don't ask me what that's about because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
He's asking those questions that I think a lot of people might not think are important, but I guess for those interested in philosophy are, you know, what is myself? How do I think? Why do I think?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, a bunch of people that are not academics figure out how to make millions by writing self-help books about what your dad writes about.
Right, right.
So you start drawing at the age of, or in the sixth grade, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You do your research. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Yeah. Sixth grade, I met my, who's still my best friend, Josh, who was drawing for a long time, and he just did funny doodles. I'm like, I can do that. I think. It took me a while to even, get that kind of confidence to say, yes, I can do that. But yeah, sixth grade.
And why was that cool to you? Just because Josh was your friend? Like, I remember in kindergarten sketching airplanes because my friend at the time was also sketching airplanes. But did you get something out of it other than that? Because I quickly abandoned drawing after he was no longer my friend. So
screw airplanes.
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, because he and I talk a lot about this still, where he was kind of that, I don't want to say the bad kid, but he was drawing like the edgy stuff on these binders of mm-hmm. you know, bloody scenes or animals merged with rocket launchers and stuff like this.
I thought you were going for the end credits of Superbad.
Right. But I wasn't necessarily interested in drawing that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I was for me as I think a lot of my creative relationships, there's lots of cross-pollination. This happened when I started playing music as well, where he drew and I'm like, oh, here's someone I can be in the sphere of and perhaps learn from, because I was interested in comic books, whereas he wasn't. Like, I wanted to draw the X-Men and stuff like that. And what tends to happen with me when I pursue anything kind of creative is I try to learn how to do it. And as soon as I have some sort of mild handle on it, I start making my own stuff. Even if that isn't my goal, it's just kind of, I'm like, oh, now I'm making characters and sharing them with Josh, and he's making his, and we start creating in that kind of shared space. I think that's if anything, it was more inspirational. It's like, oh, I have things I want to say. I'm in sixth grade. I don't have a whole lot to say.
Right.
I just want to draw cool stuff or say cool stuff. But there's a creativity that I wanted to. By that point, I'd already been writing stories and stuff like that, but writing's boring to a sixth grader, you know? Mm-hmm. And I want to do something more visceral, more visual, something that could get other people to react, you know, positively, one would hope.
What do you think allows you to pick up on those things? rather easy. So every time I pick up a guitar and try, I'm just like, F this.
Right. You know?
And there are plenty of people in this world that aspire to be musicians, et cetera. But as soon as they think about it in a logistical way, right, they're like, screw this.
Right.
So what do you think it's in you that allows you to pick up on those things?
I think with drawing specifically, there was, and there still is, I guess, an artistic lineage in my family. My dad's father was a commercial artist who tried to break out on his own, but ended up, well, for a variety of reasons, didn't end up getting that way, mostly because he died. But my dad draws all the time. He was taking it more seriously when he was a teenager and stuff like that, but then found academics and pushed his creative endeavors towards that angle. And so for in that sense, I kind of saw a footpath. I'm like, oh, I can pick that up, I guess. But in terms of, I don't know, there's with music, let's just say, or even with teaching, I guess, let's just start with music, because that is a punishing hobby, especially with guitar, because it hurts, right? I'm sure pretty much any instrument can hurt in some way, because you're reshaping your musculature to an extent. But, you know, and drawing, I was bad for a very long time. Some might say I still am, but there's always something I can see in a drawing I do where I'm like, oh, I nailed that. How did I do that? And keep practicing and trying. And I think for me, I get that obsessive angle on it. When I first started drawing, on my website, I just, every Friday I do a Sketch Friday drawing, which is just a random doodle kind of thing. And over the last couple months, I've been redrawing and redesigning characters that Josh and I created in high school. And it's been wonderfully sort of cathartic and eye-opening, but it, more than anything, it has me pull out these sketchbooks from 94, 95, when I kind of was really starting to figure out what drawing was, and just seeing how much I drew, but in the space of a year, just how much I progressed from these very rudimentary drawings and copies of drawings to actually getting an understanding of anatomy, of figures in space, and going like, even if I tried hard now, I wouldn't see that level of improvement. But so, and with guitar, I remember practicing so much, just playing, trying to learn how to play every song and like Clapton Unplugged. That was my jam when I first started playing guitar. And waking up in the morning and my knuckles were swollen. I couldn't close my hand. I thought, I'm dying. This is it. This is finally going to get me. The big C, which somehow correlates to swollen knuckles. But just getting to a point where I can be comfortable probably to make my own stuff. And once I hit that kind of, not plateau, but once I hit past that gateway, I kind of normalize. I kind of figure out where my groove is and should actually have to start pressing myself to improve, to practice, to get better. So I think for me, there's this innate drive to want to, anything new, I want to see what I can do with it rather than just, you know, doing a jam at a friend's house with a bunch of other people with guitars. Like, that's fun, but I'm more interested in maybe writing music or creating characters or coming up with a story or something like that. That, and then maybe that's just the only child who spent a lot of time in my house kind of thing, where I needed to entertain myself.
Well, I was going to say, do you think obsession is possible for everyone? So everyone that's not obsessed, do you think they just get distracted by things like sitcoms and Friends and work,
sure,
et cetera?
Yeah. I think you make a good point where it actually obsession is a gradient, right? And doesn't just have to be over, you know, specific, what, you know, I tell people I'm learning how to play guitar or drawing, and like, oh, that's so great. But people look down, it's like, oh, I binged, you know, a whole season of the show. They're like, why? You know, and but it's ultimately the same thing. This is obsession, and ostensibly people are getting something out of that, right? Out of binging. I binge podcasts. Like, there's the true crime wave going on, and I just eat that stuff up.
Yeah.
Just full seasons of podcasts are out, and I listen to the whole thing while walking the dog or doing yard work or something like that. And so, I mean, I've experienced on both sides. But yeah, I think obsession is kind of like this natural tendency. Maybe because of how much we have to obsess over today. I'm not, there's a lot of opportunities to invest your attention.
Yeah.
Right?
Did your dad encourage you to draw?
No.
Yeah.
And neither my mom, I don't think I was discouraged either, but I was very much raised in that household, probably because both my parents have advanced degrees. It's always like, you're going to college to get a good job. And I guess the folly of my youth was to, I never asked what is a good job.
Right.
Right. There's, and I, it was mostly about get a good job where you can make lots of money. And I'm like, well, what does that do? And so every hobby I pursued, I think both of them were kind of like, that's cute, you know, that's fun. But, because of that, I got a lot of support, but not a lot of guidance, not in a negative way. I think it was actually kind of, it worked out for me in the long run. I got to find what I wanted to do and try to do a bunch of things at the same time. But, no, in terms of the creative aspect, I have strong memories of when my dad actually looked at what I drew or read what I wrote and said, oh, this is actually really good. Mm-hmm. And those memories stand out because it wasn't like, oh, you can keep doing it. You can do it. You can get better. It was just these minor sort of successes I had, which I think is kind of interesting considering I don't think, because art was so present and artistic creativity was so present, especially in his side of the family, where I should ask him why, but it doesn't really matter. But the idea that yeah, probably because he, I don't want to say rejected his own artistic endeavors. He, like I said, he still draws a lot, usually cartoons on napkins for people he knows and mm-hmm. waitresses and stuff like that. But, I guess for both my parents, it never seemed like a viable occupational mm-hmm. possibility.
And so when you leave those high school doors for the last time, what do you think you're going to do with your life?
I wanted to be an animator. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get involved with animation. My style was, I was in those 90s comics when I first started, which if you don't know, they were highly detailed. That's the era of big guns, big boobs, broken backs and, mm-hmm. and blood everywhere. Like I loved it cause I was 14 mm-hmm. and, I noticed over time, slowly my style was originally trying to echo that. Lots of detail, lots of lines, but I'm not very patient at that kind of stuff. And my style started getting more and more simple, just focusing on figures and, like I said, sort of positioning people in space, trying to create a 3D look for a character, not with rendering, but just making they look right, in a sense, mm-hmm. and being able to draw a person in a variety of positions and not make it look weird. It looks like, oh, there's a person walking or there's a person turning. And that really intrigued me. And luckily, a junior college that was in my home area had animation programs, and I pursued that for what it was worth. But that didn't work out either.
And I guess it was a viable option because you were, what, an hour and a half from Disneyland? And
right.
Apparently, you were just going to show up and knock on their door and be like, here's my resume.
Or something like that. Yeah. I think the in terms of animation, the goal would be to go to a larger animation school like CalArts, which is mm-hmm. the Disney feeder, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word. But this is also, I got discouraged when I kind of stopped following animation. One, I wasn't very good at it because I'm too slow to do that many drawings, between 10 and 24 drawings a second. I didn't have that kind of patience either. Mm-hmm. but I was also at the same time when traditionally drawn animated stuff was kind of falling away and 3D stuff like Toy Story was happening and getting lots of stream. We started getting Shrek and the Pixar stuff. And all of a sudden at the time when I was ready to start making that next step towards doing something in animation, specifically traditional hand-drawn animation, that field kind of evaporated. I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, well, what are we going to do now? Mm-hmm. So, which led to a lot of my academic pursuits towards English, as well as me actually flunking out of college my first try. Mm-hmm. But it was a really interesting position, not world-ending, obviously, but it was kind of like everything I was kind of training for was going away. I'm like, well, what do I do, right? Aside from just being so self-confident to walk up to a door and say, knock, knock, hire me, mm-hmm. Which I certainly didn't have the confidence to do.
Yeah, and apparently you asked yourself that question so much that you quit drawing, correct?
I did, yeah. After I was working as an intern for an upstart video game company in a city called Lompoc, which is about an hour south of San Luis Obispo. The Vandenberg Air Force Base is near there. And they moved me from animation to character design and storyboarding. But they weren't kind of moving forward with their project. They lost their investors, and I didn't really have the foresight to keep a lot of the art I made for them. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had a year and a half of work disappear, And I'm like, well, it's not worth it at this point. So that's when I became an English major. Like, let's just go the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. Letters are lines on paper, just like drawings, right? It's the same thing.
So I have students that aspire to work in video game companies all the time. So what is that like? Is it the fantasy everybody thinks of?
Well, this is a startup, so yeah. Kind of yes, kind of no. There wasn't a lot of direction. We ended up, well, for the art side of things, we ended up drawing for half the day and then spending the rest playing Unreal Tournament against each other. And that was a bit discouraging because I was still kind of in the heat of drawing then. I was getting really good and drawing all the time. And like, why? I mean, games are fun. I love playing games and, shooting the programmers virtually. But because of the lack of the direction, I was creating a lot of content but not getting a lot of feedback and not getting a lot of applicable work, right? I'm like, okay, I did this drawing, but where is it going? And I wasn't seeing that progression. So initially when I got that position, I was like, this is my in, right? I can bypass going to CalArts. I don't have to go work for or try to compete against every other animator that's trying to work for Disney. This is my in. I can get a resume and maybe this company's going to work out and I can stay with them forever. And then when it fell apart because they lost their investors, started doing some other kind of like sports related app kind of thing. And before apps or program website, that's what it was. There was no place for me there. They're just like, well, we're done, Dan. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll see you later, I guess. And, it was incredibly discouraging. I didn't draw for 6 or 7 years, something like that. I doodled and stuff like that, but no serious, I should pursue this as a profession kind of work.
So no Long John video game in the future.
I wouldn't turn it down, but but it would have to be involve close work with me.
So you turned down your first obsession, which is drawing. Why is English your next obsession?
Obsession might be an interesting word. I think English, of all the things, was just the skill that was always hiding in plain sight. Like I'd always been writing stories ever since elementary school. I'd always done well in my English classes, but I never considered it as a profession. To the point where in junior college, I was taking an English class, and I was an art major. I'm like, hell yes, this is what I'm doing. And I kept getting really positive response from my teacher, to the point where on one of my essays, I still have it, he says, at the end, on his comments, he said, are you sure you don't want to be an English major? And of course, at 18 years old, I'm like, of course not, don't be insane. That's not where I'm going. But when I decided to pursue English, aside from the idea that I kind of given up drawing, it was a bit selfish. I'm like, well, English was always easy. Let's see where it goes. And then it really wasn't until I got into the master's program at Sac State where I realized where my obsession with regard to this field was, which was teaching writing, which kind of brought together all my interests I'm teaching like the freshman level composition classes, right? Those class everybody has to take, the class that no one wants to take, right? But I love it because, writing is where all my other creative interests spurred from. I always wanted to create my own stuff, whether it's art or music or prose. And what composition teaching this essay writing, even though it's a very staid or academic format, there is a creative aspect in there, and that's what I learned about myself when, after flunking out of college my first try, I went back and I said, how do I succeed? I'm like, well, what am I good at? What do I know I can actually get stuff done doing? And it was drawing at that point. I'm like, well, how do I draw? And I thought about it as a process, for lack of a better word, where you don't start with the perfect line. You start with mess. You start with general shapes, and then you fill in the details. I'm like, well, what if I tried that with writing an essay? And it, for me, when I kind of created that framework for myself, it worked really well. And I graduated from college really quickly after I kind of, not because of that, but reframing academics, I thought something I hated in high school and junior high. I was never particularly a good student. But once I framed it within a scope that I could understand, creativity in this case, artistic creativity and self-expression, then it all kind of fell into place for me. And so after getting my bachelor's degree, I unsuccessfully tried getting a job with a bachelor's in English. And I'm like, well,
Yeah, what does that look like? I'm always curious. I'm in the profession, but so no offense to my English colleagues, but I'm always curious what English people tell the English majors that what they're going to do with their life.
Right. Luckily, in my position, I don't have to talk to a lot of English majors. it's funny because when I was an art major, I kind of quickly hated being an art major because I thought there was a lot of pretentiousness, a lot of just people just singing to the choir, so to speak. I didn't really feel like there was a whole lot of idealistic or ideological challenges to each other. And when I became an English major, because I didn't really get into like the literature side of it, but I found a lot of that kind of attitudes of people just kind of praising each other and their ideas, which is fine. That's all good. But not really, I didn't see the applicability of talking about what the wolves mean in White Fang, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care. Is it a good book or not? So I kind of pushed away a bit from the English major mentality as well. But my experience with a bachelor's degree in English was I had a wonderful year selling DVDs at a Barnes & Noble,
mm-hmm.
right? Other than that, the only job offerings I was getting that were actually looking at my CV were, writing copy for an insurance company. Like, I don't want to do that, right? During the year between my degrees, I kind of figured, well, what do I want to do? And it was, I want to talk about writing all the time, as well mm-hmm. as do it, right? And so how do I do that? Well, teaching is a great way to do that. Excuse me. And it wasn't until I got into Sac State that I realized there's actually even a sub-focus in English that just does that.
Mm-hmm.
When I originally applied to my master's, to the master's program here, I applied as a creative writing focus with the idea that you need a master's degree kind of in anything to teach at a junior college.
Right.
That was my goal. And so I'm like, well, creative writing, I get to talk about writing all day. But once in my first semester, I was forced to take a composition class for senior level or fourth year English majors because they didn't trust that I could write or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher was in the composition field. I'm like, what is that? That sounds weird. And she told me, like, well, the instructor told me we talk about how to teach writing. I'm like, oh, hold on. Right. And I was kind of had to choose a direction at that point. And so what do you do with a bachelor's degree in English? I don't know. Cause I didn't do much, but if I had the opportunity to talk to an English major, I would be afraid to just echo what every other person says to English majors. Oh, you want to teach?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that does seem to be the easy way to go. Either going to a post-baccalaureate level degree or going into secondary education. Or, I mean, to be perfectly honest, the nice thing about an English degree is that it is kind of a multi-purpose degree. You kind of can do, I don't want to say anything, but it does set you up for working in a business environment or a corporate environment, stuff like that.
Are you ever pissed off at yourself before the master's program that I spent all this time on an English degree and now I'm selling DVDs at a Barnes & Noble?
No, not at all, actually. There was a point in my life where I was like, I'm not going to get a bachelor's degree. Uh-huh. I was pretty convinced after I flunked out. So I went to a junior college for 2.5 years, let's just say. I'm rounding down. I applied to go to Cal Poly, and I got rejected. And then I'm going to say it on the record, and then my dad got me in.
Yeah.
Right? And I was paying $200 a quarter, which even at that point was really, really cheap. And so what did I do after my first quarter there? I flunked out. I stopped going to some classes. I went to one class where the guy had a cool accent but didn't do any work. And I was like, I don't want to be here. And so I didn't go. And then after that fell apart, I ran away from my shame. My girlfriend and I, we just moved to Chico, California for no reason. Chico is kind of known for being a party town, but mm-hmm. I didn't drink. I was 21 mm-hmm. years old. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I didn't socialize. But we just went to go somewhere else. And that's where, that's the first time I moved out of my own hometown. And just existed, you know, and made money for the first time really in my life, saved money for the first time mm-hmm. in my life. And actually we had a 3-bedroom apartment next to a pool. I'm like, this is pretty nice. But mm-hmm. after a year I got super bored. And like, I was writing a lot. I was getting back into drawing. I was playing guitar a lot, but I didn't see, or I didn't have the confidence to pick a direction. And so I'm like, well, what's the best option for me? And I said, probably a bachelor's degree. And so I said, Dad, is there any way I can get back to Cavalli? And he's like, probably not, but let me ask around. And I had to interview with the dean of liberal arts, and I was an academic probation. I had to check in with the dean every quarter saying, hey, I'm not failing, right? Mm-hmm. But it was just kind of having that honest talk with her. My dad set up a talk with the dean to just say, just to get everything out. Like, it was like a 2-hour conversation. She said, why did you flunk out of school? I'm like, because I hate it. She's like, why'd you hate it? I'm like, well, I hated being surrounded by point chasers. That's what I called them. It's like, they're not learning anything. I was on a high horse, right? Mm-hmm. They're not learning anything. And they're just testing for regurgitation, that kind of stuff. And she's like, well, there are schools that do just focus on, you know, self-improvement and engaging in discourse. But I'm like, yeah, but those are super expensive and Ivy League, and I certainly can't get into those. And it's just, well, you have to do what you have to make of it what you will, and make it that experience for you. I'm like, okay. And having an adult conversation mm-hmm. where it wasn't just my parents telling me, you have to get a degree. You know, it actually me wanting to get a degree, wanting to be there. That was the big change for me.
And I guess selling DVDs wasn't that devastating, because the background is you're also co-collaborating and designing a comic at the same time, right?
Right, yeah. So after my bachelor's degree, I moved back east. And at the same time, local creative guru, Eben Burgoon, and I started a comic called Eben 07, a humor espionage action comic. It's about secret agent janitors. Mm-hmm. Just because I wanted to. I was originally, how deep do you want to get into Eben 07?
I was just going to say that it was interesting that you call him a guru, because I couldn't tell from all the interviews and the things that I read whether or not you two were still friends.
Yeah. Well, the comic ended over, you know, mutual agreement as well as creative differences. And, having a partnership end is hard no matter mm-hmm. what. And, you know, we're still really good friends. We definitely, it's interesting making this comic where we were creating this comic both out of not a place of desperation, but it may be boredom. We had these characters we created in high school, and I was wanting to get back in animation at that point. This is kind of at the end of that lull. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing an Eben 07 animated short, at least storyboarding it, right? Creating little drawings, comic basically. And I'm like, oh, wait, animation's hard. what else can I do? And then I started talking with Eben about it, because it was his likeness technically. And he's a writer. And we both started creating this story, this world at the very least, and fleshing out these characters. And like, oh, we should do a web comic. That was something I was really into at that point. And he took on the web development aspect of it. And I co-wrote and drew it and colored it and inked it and lettered it and all that fun stuff. And we started that in 2007 just to throw it out there and see if it stuck anywhere. And we did that for 6 years mm-hmm. ultimately.
Yeah, in a previous interview, you talked about how to monetize online, and I think that was in 2009. So mm-hmm. what did that look like, and what lessons did you learn from that you're putting into your current work?
Well, back then, it's interesting. The revenue on the internet is a very sort of nebulous creature.
Yeah. Right?
Back then, it was all about having ads on the site, usually through... The webcomics kind of had the centralized hub called Project Wonderful, where webcomickers would submit ads and kind of like almost an auction system. You put in this much money and you submit it to this site, and if you win the bid, so to speak, and depending on how much money you put in there, you kind of get so much time on someone's website. And that's mm-hmm. that, and Google Ads were popular, still are. But it made enough to sustain the cost of running a website, which was nice. It was, to that end, it was self-sufficient. Once we started making books and stuff, it became a little more costly. But that model is all but dead. And lots of, I'm sure there are still ad networks. I know with audio, of course, the rise of the ad network is happening mm-hmm. pretty quickly. And as far as what I took from there, what I took from that to apply to my current comic is actually I'm doing the opposite. Mainly because I know I can't spend as much time devoted to the comic like I did to that previous comic. So I have no ads on my site. I'm just going to, whatever word of mouth is generated, I'll let that take it where it goes. And to that end, it's pointing me towards the goal that I want rather than having it maybe blow up when I didn't want it to. Not that it has, but it's getting readers and enthusiasts that actually invest in the comic, not monetarily, but in terms of, I like this. I like what you're doing. Let's talk about it. That kind of stuff. So I'm cultivating it by doing the opposite, not because that the old ways were bad. I'm actually, it made me ask the question, what kind of audience do I want? What kind of interaction do I want? What kind of presence do I want this new comic to have? Mm-hmm. And to that end, it's been working, you know, absolutely fine, but, generating, I mean, aside from book sales, very little revenue, but I'm not looking at it as a way to sustain myself. I luckily have a job to do that. So,
and in hindsight, your relationship never made sense to me. Or I was thinking about this last night. In terms of Eben was the one that was the writer, mm-hmm. and you're the English guy. So,
right,
that didn't make sense to me. So, did it make sense to you when you were originally, or did you want to be involved in story the whole time?
I did want to be involved in the story, and luckily, you know, we had a very collaborative relationship for most of the experience. But yeah, that was a question that came up a lot because pretty much the entirety, aside from that first year of the comic, the entirety of that comic's existence, I was in grad school to get a master's degree in English. And whenever mm-hmm. that came out, in conversation at local shows and whatnot, it's like, so you're the writer? I'm like, no, I co-write and I draw it. And so they asked, what do you do? And I, you know, it was really, it felt, you know, it's not the best question to be asked, especially if, you know, I felt bad, you know, and I think the heart of the comic and the sort of, tone of the comic and the general progression of the stories came from him. And my job was more editorial, I would say, which I think I'm pretty good at. And, going back to the question, the interesting thing I think about my creative development, and this is something that's I've really grabbed onto with the end of Eben 07, was that because of my dad calls it the Bethel existence of just having a general lack of confidence. Every creative endeavor I've ever done, going back to making characters with my friend Josh in the sixth grade, I always had to be working with somebody. I never felt like I could do it on my own, you know? And so when I started playing music, I'm like, I want to be in a band with someone and, rely on them to kind of carry the load. And it wasn't until 5 or 6 years ago where I'm like, you know what? I think I'm actually good enough to do this. You know, mm-hmm. why do I need other people? So it wasn't necessarily, I think for Eben was kind of feeling that as well. Not necessarily with the drawing aspect, but he, at the time of the end of Eben 07, he was starting to develop another project that he's doing right now, B Squad. And I was kind of getting as I was seeing him do that and trying to going out to hire artists and developing a website and starting to talk about that. I'm like, well, as a guy that draws, I can't draw more than one project at a time. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to be your side project now kind of thing. And that's where maybe any bitterness kind of came from. It wasn't anything he generated. It was, you know, my own ego getting in the way. And so I'm like, well, I want to do other stuff too. And that's where I'm like, Long John sort of popped up from my sketchbooks and I wanted to go that direction. And so that was the biggest decider. We both wanted to do other things. Let's go do other things. And what comes with that is saying, okay, I'm going to do this on my own mm-hmm. and really kind of be, you know, build the brand of not only Long John, the current comic, but build the brand of Dan Bethel, or as I go online as D Bethel. But, yeah, so that's kind of the arc and
you talk about Long John being a character, a Clint Eastwood character that you want to make cry.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a line in, I think, the first chapter that says, I think the girl tells him this, or maybe, yeah, you're not one of them.
Right.
Do you think that's you?
Oh, man. You want to make me cry. maybe. I mean, I think, yeah, yes, if you want to be absolutely blunt, that is me. And that goes back to why I'm probably creative. Like I was saying, I grew up as an only child in a broken home, and my mom worked for a prison. And so she was active in a lot of programs and stuff like that. And so, I was home alone a lot, which is fine. There were aspects of my early life that made me kind of become, for lack of a better word, a shut-in. My mom was the first, my mom was the first female correctional counselor at this medium security prison. She always jokes that she got the job because of affirmative action, not because of her skill. Like, whatever. You worked there for 40 years, mom. Get over it. You were good at your job. Mm-hmm. But with that came a lot of, you know, stress, anxiety that would come with being the first female or woman employee, or at least correctional counselor, where she's dealing one-on-one with inmates, to the point where we had to kind of protect ourselves. We had to delist our phone number, and there was a person that was saying a lot of things that basically, once I get out of here, I'm going to take you two away and you will live like kings. I'm like, well, you kind of murdered people, so we probably don't want to go away with you. Right. And so some of my earliest memories were, you know, don't go outside. If any stranger talks to you, here's how to make noise. Here's how to get the attention of people. Run to a, if you are alone in public, run to a woman, not to a man. Right. Trust the police, which, you know, is an interesting situation to say nowadays. But that led me to being this very kind of introverted kid that felt really strange. This is the mid-80s as well. So I was the first divorced kid I knew. And in a pretty affluent city like San Luis Obispo, nobody else I knew at the time was divorced or had divorced mm-hmm. parents. And so I did feel like I wasn't one of them. But I always wanted to connect, not in terms of I always wanted to have lots of friends. I never felt lonely, but I wanted to still feel like I could contribute. I could make people happy in this case. And so I think most of my creative fuel comes from that. That's that very primordial and a primitive or what's the word? Sort of nascent need to feel like, even though I'm different and weird and outside, I can still be a part of everybody and everything else, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you need to reframe that in future interviews, that you're not one of them is your strike to I'm no longer a Bethel without confidence.
Right. I like it. Absolutely.
So we'll work on that.
Oh, okay. Sounds good. You're hired. You're hired. My personal coach.
So you get your MA. Why do you stay in SAC?
Obviously there's a lot of strains there. My wife was doing well at her job. She's an environmental scientist. She got what I call a real degree. Mm. You know, I learned that it takes two English degrees to maybe equal one science degree. But, she was doing well here, liking the work. But we were looking at other places. We were thinking about going to Denver. We had a friend out there. My friend Josh was out there, actually. And we're thinking of maybe going to Oregon. And that was going pretty late. And once it got to the sort of end of my master's program and I was getting ready to graduate, we had to ask, where do we want to go? And in all of our talks, and there were a lot of talks, we're going like, well, Sacramento's pretty cool. We love the river, right? Growing up next near the ocean, I was always kind of used to being near a body of water, and the river for me at least was answering that call. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were kayaking and we were hiking, and the nice thing about Sacramento, I think I stole this line from Oh Brother Where Art Thou, but it's kind of 2 hours from everywhere you want to be. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go to the beach, to the ocean, you can. If you want to go to the mountains, you can. The forests, the desert, you know, it's in a very nice centralized location. And ultimately, we kind of sealed the deal, if you want to be absolutely pragmatic about it, is that we bought a house. You know, and it's like, okay, I guess we're staying for a while. Mm-hmm. Which also was bolstered by the fact that I got hired at Sac State to teach there. But, you know, these opportunities were presenting themselves And we just kind of asked, is this bad or good? And we both said good. And so, you know, just kind of like Sacramento has done nothing, you know, I don't want to say it. I think we found a part of the city also that we're comfortable living in, and it gives us access to the freeways and going into Midtown and downtown and out to the mountains if you want. And it just kind of had everything. It's a nice centralized hub for the life we want to live, I guess is the way to put it. But it made a good home base. And also just for me as a teacher, like I said before, just I can't imagine anywhere else, at least in the state, perhaps. Well, there are probably other places, but just where the student body is so interesting and well, I feel so base saying the word, but so diverse, you know, that I'm still getting a lot out of working with this population that I feel like to go anywhere else would be to deprive personal growth in that sense.
Is there a city where you're supposed to move to if you're a comic person? Like, is there a country music of Nashville or
not really? I think San Francisco is probably a good place to go.
Yeah.
But so much of artwork as well as comics are online now. You can do it from everywhere. If anything, there is a pretty good emigration happening towards Toronto or Vancouver up in Canada. But that seems like a lot of work, you know, I don't think so. If you wanted to break into like professional comics, like Marvel or DC stuff, I'm sure there's probably a place to go. But those have never interested me at all. So I think Sacramento is as good place as any.
What is your long-term goal of Long John?
To finish it. If wishes were fishes, the idea would be to finish it, make a book, hopefully have stats for people to come to visit the site and go to larger publishers and say, here's a book. There's an audience for it. You don't need to, you know, I don't need to keep working on it. It would be good for your library as well as my resume. Just what do you think? And it sounds hackneyed, but I know it's been done. There are people that have done that with their web comics saying, hey, this is a book that's been getting some traction. Would you like to publish it? And they say, this is good for me too. And, then I would just go on to do the next thing.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So it's not Long John itself isn't the end goal. It's just being able to finish it and go on with the next step. But if it doesn't find a home, that's fine too. You know, luckily I'm in a position where I position myself to have this kind of dual career, for lack of a better word, even though it's not a 50-50 split, where the job I have allows me to pay for and sustain the comicking. And so far that's fine with me. You know, it allows me the freedom to do that.
You said you didn't have the patience for animation. What you do now doesn't make sense to me that you made that answer. So you started this sometime in 2014.
Right.
And it's not done.
Right.
And while I was watching a couple interviews with you on YouTube, I was reading Long John at the same time. And I think I got through Long John in an hour. So two years worth of work.
Yep.
In an hour.
Yep. That's the problem with comics as well. If you see those big books like, what are something like Blankets or Essex County or something like that? Mm-hmm. These are these huge books, bigger than most novels out there, but you can still get through them in 2 hours. That's the nature of the medium, being mostly visual and having very little to read, right? And especially coming from perhaps an English background, that is endlessly frustrating for me. It's like I could technically, but just make it all prose and actually get all the detail in there that I wanted and explain everything and have it take up much less space and have more time. Sorry, it would require the reader to take more time to get through it, but you lose the visual element. So it is a tug and pull of expectations. But yeah, I think the biggest push against working faster is being a full-time teacher.
Right.
You know? And like I said, I'm a bit of an idealist when it comes to my work. And so for me, the idea was, you know, I can balance. I can, you know, I'll have maybe weekends or at least spring breaks, winter breaks, and summer breaks to work on the comic. But the winter break and spring break happen. Well, the spring break obviously happens in the middle of a term,
right?
And just winter's bridging the two terms. So I'm always just thinking about my students. When I'm working as a teacher, then all I care about is my students, because being a teacher, at least the way I view it, it's not about me, that time in there. I need to make sure that they are writing and that they're giving a shit about what they write.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a creative tool. So it's kind of a switch in my brain. Like I have to maybe not switch, but I have the pipeline of creativity. I got to unplug it from comics and plug it into mm-hmm. pedagogy and make sure that all that focus is going to them. And I probably, it gives me anxiety and stuff like that. I probably should back off, but to me that's what helps me do a good job. And so if anything, stalls the comic, it's definitely that. Just I can't do two things at once, mm-hmm. as much as I try, mm-hmm. without the risk of just having sloppy efforts on both sides of that wall.
When you finished your master's program and you were done with Ebon 07, you said the reason why Ebon 07 was done is you wanted to tell other stories. Mm-hmm. So why was telling Long John's story first important to you?
It was fun to draw. That's one. Yeah. That's an important thing to keep in mind. I liked the idea of trying to do this balance of sort of a popular genre, as popular as a Western can be, but also maybe approaching it with a bit of a postmodern deconstructionist kind of point of view. So trying to bridge in a single text the two sides of my life, of kind of the English major side as well as the, you know, the pop culture comicking kind of side, and see, even if it's overall a failed attempt, to see if I can do it, and especially in a world that I'm interested. My interest in history is really interesting around that sort of 1860s to 1890s kind of period in Western history, and especially there's a lot going on there in California that's particularly interesting that isn't talked a whole lot about in Westerns, right? I think there should be more Westerns where you can see the coastline, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, because people were shooting each other out here as much as they were in Texas and you know, mm-hmm. Oklahoma and stuff like that. So, I mean, just the whole thing fascinated me. And knowing what I'm good at drawing, I was glad I didn't have to draw cars or like buildings or, you know, complicated machinery. That stuff just bores me. Mm-hmm. and I got pretty good at it with Ebon 07. It was, you know, it's that comic was a pastiche of James Bond and stuff like that. So I got to draw gadgetry, but I learned that it's difficult for at least my patience to take. So drawing arid landscapes is right in my wheelhouse, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I was going to say, why aren't there more stories about California? It's too green, and it doesn't look like a Western, or what?
That is a good question. I there's not a lot of popularized, you know, tall tales, I guess, from California that exist in popular culture. And like, even though some of the famous gunslingers and stuff ended up in California at some point, I think maybe there's something with truth being stranger than fiction. I think if you tried to pitch a coastal Western, people would be like, bullshit. Right? No, what? No. Is it going to go shoot 10 guys and then go surfing? I think it might be a hard sell. I guess I say that with too much. It would be a hard sell, I think. But I don't know. Maybe just there is, especially being such an old genre, I think there are expectations that a lot of people feel they need to meet in terms of visuals and even accents and stuff like that they need to meet for people to accept it. And that's one of the things I'm proud of Long John, is that I'm trying to either buck some of the trends or twist some of them to an extent to the point where people are seeing a Western in a new light that they can accept. And so far the response has been pretty good. So I'm mm-hmm. crossing my fingers.
And how much of what you wanted to do when you started writing Long John and now 2 years later, mm-hmm. how much of that original thought is still there? Like, how much has the story changed in your mind, or has it?
It's gotten more detailed. The one thing I would say of myself as a writer, I'm much more of a character guy. I like a Philip Roth novels where it's just a guy basically talking to himself for 150 pages. I'm not much of a plot guy because I don't think I'm really good at following plots in movies, mm-hmm. but it also seems to, in a lot of cases, it seems to kind of, stories tend to be either plot-based or character-based, and the twain don't meet very often. And so this is a story about this character. I don't really take the camera away from him, from focusing on him too often. When I do, it's for a very specific purpose. So it's about trying to get him kind of to the point of, like you said at the beginning, of trying to make a Clint Eastwood style character break down. What would actually make this person stop being the stone cold badass that he's always been presented to be? And so I like the idea of showing that change happen slowly, showing him descend into depths that we didn't see a Clint Eastwood type character go, and ascending to heights that we haven't seen the same type of character go either. And so if it's changed at all, I've developed the plot much more. I had a general sort of tent poles that I was trying to hit, but over the last couple of years or so, I've just been thinking about what is he going to do, since I have the character kind of nailed down, since I've been thinking about this character forever. Like, well, what are the different trials I could put him through? What are the different scenarios I can put him through? And actually nailing down, like, oh, this scene is going to happen. This is going to happen in this scene, and this scene comes after this scene. I'm like, okay, look at me. I'm a plot guy. Huh, this is exciting, right? And actually getting to a point where, okay, this is, yes, not only is it plot, and this has been the biggest obstacle for me as a writer ever since I've been writing, or at least trying to approach it in a semi-professional manner, is have it be a plot that actually agrees with my aesthetics. That it feels like a, for lack of a better word, a Dan Bethel story, and not just, oh, here is a plot that I can follow. It's actually something that I feel is not necessarily unique to me, but definitely speaks to my tendencies and my goals as a creative.
But arguably, you would be much more successful if you just picked a plot.
Sure.
Stuck to it, right?
Right. But again, it's funny talking to you. The thing that keeps popping up that I wasn't necessarily expecting was my patience, right? If it's a pre-planned plot or a cookie cutter plot, I'm sure I'd get super bored real quickly and go F this noise. So actually kind of finding an organic way to a plot, even if, let's just be honest, the plot I've come up with is probably not groundbreaking, and it's not revolutionary, it's not going to turn heads, but at least it's something that came from me thinking about these characters and the story I wanted to tell. And so even if it is a cookie cutter plot, at least it's a mold or a pattern I created rather than just picking from a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the other side of that argument is if you pick a cookie cutter plot, there is no patience because you get it done a lot faster.
Right, right, right. Right. So that comes to the other side of patience, which is boredom, right? I have no patience for boredom. Mm-hmm. I always have to be doing something, which is probably my biggest detriment as a creative person. Like, I'm stuck drawing. Let's go play guitar for a couple hours. Oh, I don't want to do that. Let's go play video games, or let's go write or something like that. I always have to be doing something, so to stave off potential boredom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also run a podcast called
For All Intents and Purposes.
There you go. Yeah. do you see that? Because I don't listen to your podcast, A, because I didn't know about it until a month ago.
That's right.
And B, I'm not into most of that stuff.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I just had the neurovirus last week, and I watched Iron Fist, and I saw all the Facebook stuff about nerds being pissed about Iron Fist. And I was like, it's fine.
Yeah.
So do you see that much in the comics that you enjoy, that they're out of the box? Because it seems to me one Marvel's movie to the next Marvel's movie, it's the same cookie cutter plot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't particularly find those movies inspirational. I think they're fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen some interesting attempts at creativity and diversion from the norm with stuff like Logan or I guess Deadpool or whatnot. But I still don't see it as a big progression for the medium. But like I said, I like the Marvel movie stuff, but I'm not one of those raging fans. You know, I hope it's good.
Mm-hmm.
For the podcast, and with regard to those topics, right? I don't begrudge anybody. Let's be honest, the title is probably not correct. It's not For All Intents and Purposes, mm-hmm. but the angle on it that we take is that I co-host it with a friend, and what I'm trying to mold as the de facto editor in chief of the comic and the website is a very specific angle on those things. It's not just us going like, oh, this movie sucks or whatever. It's he's a lawyer, I'm a university professor. Let's use those skills to approach these topics. And so what's actually been developing over time with the podcast, we just hit 3 years, I think. 3 years. Is that we've gone away from talking about like, oh, did you see this trailer? It's going to be crazy or it's going to suck or something like that, to being more about this is what people are talking about. Let's try to break this down into its components. Let's try to see what people are really upset about. What is this movie that people are, or this video game that people are reacting against? Is it because it's speaking to something in our culture? Is there something that that is critically engaging with the fan base, even though they don't realize that they're being a part of a larger conversation, right? And so kind of going in through a more critical lens, more rhetorical, or in his case, a legal lens, to look at this topic that is getting a lot of coverage nowadays, hopefully through a more focused and interesting and, you know, like I said, sort of critical conversation. And so that's what we try to bring to it. So getting away from sort of just general, did you see this? Did you do that? To more, you know, what is this saying about us as people, as modern people, as nerds, as comic fans, as whatever, right? I at least that's the angle I bring to it, because that's more interesting to me, right? I'm not going to be one of the people that says, sees a trailer for Wonder Woman and go like, oh, it's going to suck or it's going to blow. I'm like, with a trailer, I'm just going to say, I hope it's good. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll judge it when it's actually a movie in front of me, mm-hmm. or something like that. But I think that's definitely plagues not only the movies, but sure, a lot of popular nerd culture media, where there is a sort of normalization of storytelling, where we kind of expect certain things. And if fans don't get those certain things, they become very, very loud. Mm-hmm. And if there's any constant from my commentary on the show has been like, let's hold on, chill, slow your roll. Like, let's just talk about it before, actually judging it, because judging is actually putting a punctuation on the sentence when it should just be a paragraph, right? Should keep the conversation going. So I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
How much do you incorporate, Long John into your teaching?
Not very much.
Yeah.
I worked for a couple of years at the Art Institute of Sacramento, which is, going north on the 5 up near Natomas. And, that was my first job out of grad school. And there I was a bit more open with what I do outside of teaching, because I'm working with creatives. I get to talk to my people, so to speak, and say, okay, now let's take this creativity and try to apply it to an academic setting. Because it worked for me, and I'm not smarter than anybody else in this room. So let's try to get you guys at least some on the path to being able to use this thing called academic writing as another mode of expression for you that you already do with programming or with drawing or with painting or with web design or whatnot. It's just another way to express yourself. Mm-hmm. And so the only time I really bring it up in class is when I talk about how I became a better student, was applying the process of drawing to a kind of to the mindset of writing academic texts, in this case, where you don't have to start with the right first sentence, right? Just go ahead and make an outline if that works for you. Just start throwing words on the page if that works for you. Find what works for you. That's the first step, right? And then you'll figure out how to pull the detail out of that malaise over time. And that's what will make you a better writer, instead of trying to force a format or process onto yourself. Ask yourself, what is the process that you already use to get things done? That's the key, because one thing I say in class is there's no wrong way to write a paper. Well, there's 3 wrong ways to write a paper: if you steal it, if you buy it, or if you hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. Right? Other than that, I don't care how you get it done. Right? If you're the kind of person that waits until midnight the night before it's due, that's fine. As long as it gets done, that's all that matters. Right? The question to ask yourself is, are you getting the papers you want out of that process? And if not, what can we do to modify, to add to give you more available tools to make the papers that you do write with whatever process you use more accurate to what you had in your head? How do we ultimately translate that thought into words on a page or words on a screen and whatnot? So that's kind of how I bring it to the classroom, is that how do I already do stuff? And I already write songs, or I already make drawings or tell stories. And that worked for me. What works for you? And that's pretty much the extent of it. Sometimes I draw on the board just as a joke. Sometimes I draw on students' papers. But beyond that, I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing. Sure, the different aspects of my life. And you know, a lot of people say I should be bringing the artistic side into the classroom. I just don't know how, and mm-hmm. I think it'd make me uncomfortable more than anything else.
Do you know that you're different when you're teaching around your colleagues, right? So the majority of your colleagues, I'm sure, were 4.0 students, and then were 4.0 and MA, and then also the doctorate. Mm-hmm. Can you tell that you're different?
No, mainly because I think I got in high school and junior high, I think I got really good at hiding.
Yeah.
I had really bad skin problems and stuff like that. And so I'm used to like people recoiling, like, well, okay, how do I just get ignored so I can do this existence? And so I think I've developed skills good enough to, be rhetorically aware enough to say, oh, okay, I'm in a room full of PhDs. Not how do I act different? How do I be disingenuous? But how do I just get seen and not, you know, pointed out in that kind of room? But I think one thing about flunking out of college, going out to work, going back east, that kind of stuff, and being a pretty sheltered kid going into a diverse world, I kind of just realize everybody's a person, you know, and everybody has full of faults and stuff like that. And I try not to, you know, hold anybody up higher than they should be. But,
well, let me ask you this a question in a different way.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about any of my current colleagues.
Right. The disclaimer. Neither am I. No way I should be. Yeah.
But I feel like the ones that were 4.0s,
right,
then went to the MA, then went PhD, they're like not relaxed. Like,
sure.
They care about all the little shit way too much.
Right, right.
And me, like, I went to college because I wanted to debate, and that's why I was there. My MA program, because I didn't want to go to the real world, and that's why I was there.
Exactly.
So do you find that you as a dropout relate better to your students?
Oh, without a doubt, right? And I think there's actually an interesting situation. I don't know what, are you comms? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what that department is like. But, I mean, as you probably know, like, my English department, a lot of English departments, we have a huge staff of adjuncts, right? Of people just like me with just their master's, because we have a lot of those first-year English classes that we need to teach and second-year English classes that we need to teach. And a lot of the PhDs, well, we don't have too many PhDs for one, but in the department, we're trying to fix that. And we just, the full professors can't teach all those classes, and so we have a large pool. So I'm sharing an office with other MA students, people that were reentry students. So actually my exposure to the PhDs isn't very prominent, because we outnumber them like 5-1. Mm-hmm. So actually what's nice is that the people I do interact regularly with, the other lecturers, are people that did have a certain situation. But the one thing I will say, and again, I don't mean to demean any of my colleagues, especially the PhDs, the people that determine whether I get to come back every year, but probably because of what you're talking about, but also just necessity of the job requirements, they do get mired in the office politics and all the different committees and stuff that they have to be on, where, yeah, there is a... I saw this a lot with my dad, too. That's my out. In the philosophy department. With the philosophy department at Cal Poly at the time, there was a lot of, like, for lack of a better word, pettiness, perhaps, but just, yeah, the small shit that really fires them up. But it's their department, you know, that is their world that they're trying to craft, and they have to hire all the people, they have to make the choices to spend all this money to bring in another person, a new person with a PhD, to make sure that they not only can be the font of knowledge for that specific subject, like we're looking for a romantic poet person or something like that, or we're looking for another comp teacher or something like that. That they're looking at the department on a very different level than I am. because I don't have to, right? I just have to worry about making sure that my 130 students or whatever are getting the best education I can give them. They can worry about, oh, how are we going to rewrite the course goals for all of our levels of classes and stuff like that, and securing budgets for the writing center and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that kind of stuff, I do see the difference. But luckily, in the departmental environment that I'm in, I don't have to actually engage with that kind of aspect too much. But when there are mixers and stuff like that, we do kind of coordinate each other off in a sense. Not like PhDs have to stay over there, but this is, you know, the people that know each other stay with each other. Right. So all the PhDs are hanging out and all our lecturers are hanging out. And even within the lecturers, since there's so many of us, we're all hanging out in our own little groups and stuff like that. It's there is a difference there, no doubt. But they've never really, if there's any sort of focusing or sort of differences of treatment, it might be more towards the different focus of the English department that you're in, like lit people, and there's the composition people, and there's the creative writing people, and the TESOL people. Like, there's more kind of side eyes and and discussion and you know, cliquishness in that aspect more than lecturers to PhDs.
What does it mean to you to be a comic book creator living in Sacramento right now?
Right now, it's a wonderful place to be. We have a really active local creative pool. Lots of people are making comics, making art, and they're all really nice, which is really helpful. And you know, people have asked me, am I going to try to go to the bigger shows like San Diego Comic Con and pay way too much money for a booth or something like that? I'm like, no, I like the local shows because, especially for someone that doesn't go outside a lot, it's the time where I get to go hang out with people I know and just kind of shoot the breeze for a day, as well as trying to sell books and posters and stuff. But it's a very warm environment. Now, I will say this with Ebon 07, and like when I referred to Ebon as the local guru, is that he's done a really good job at bringing the local talent out more. He's really good at holding events and meetups where these people, us can come out and meet each other. And I think his biggest success in that regard is the CrockerCon. You familiar with that, with the Crocker Art Museum every September? He's the guy that came to them and said, how about a local comic book convention of local artists at the art museum? And you know, that's been an astounding success, and I love that show probably more than any other show I do, which isn't a whole lot to say because I only do like two shows. So because of being involved with him and meeting all the people through him, I've actually created really long-term friendships in the long run, especially people that maybe wanted to do comics but never knew how or didn't know that they could. Seeing them do comics now and being pretty successful at it has been really heartwarming. It's like, yeah, go. We need more representation from the area. So it's a wonderful time to be a comicker in Sacramento.
What advice would you give to folks that are reading all the magazine articles about how Sacramento is the next great destination? What advice would you give those folks before moving here?
Oh, man. be nice. I don't know what good advice I can give, since considering I moved here without much respect for the city. It was a courtship on behalf of the city that I didn't realize was happening. That before long, I'm like, I actually really like it here. And so I think it can get it's going to be an interesting couple years because people are being priced out of San Francisco and stuff like that, and with headlines like that going out saying Sacramento's next great place to be. I'm like, well, there's already something special here. Let's try not to make it into little San Francisco, right? Going back to San Luis Obispo real quick, the local hotspot for people to go to, like the San Francisco to San Luis Obispo is Santa Barbara. And people love that and always talk about it. And one thing that kind of bummed me out about San Luis, and I know there are friends of mine that don't agree, my wife being one of them, said, I saw this progression of San Luis trying to become a little Santa Barbara. Like, let's try to mimic even more of the architecture that place has and try to create that kind of vibe. I'm like, but you're not, you know, you're never going to be Santa Barbara. So stop trying to be this thing called San Luis Obispo. And, you know, I think Sacramento has something, a more defined identity than San Luis Obispo ever had. And, it's pretty special, especially from what I've learned about kind of right before I moved here, 8 years ago. Yeah. 8 years, almost 9 years ago, 9 years ago. Whoa. Where it like about 10, 12 years ago, it went through a big change, especially Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing what Midtown has become has been pretty fascinating. And it's like, it kind of did this all on its own, you know, good job, Sacramento. If people want to come here making it another San Francisco or some hip, cool place, like, it's already pretty cool, guys. Just let Sacramento be Sacramento. Mm-hmm. That's the best advice I give, and it's pretty hyperbolic. Sorry.
Sacramento has been known as a cow town, a government town. The word boring has been said before on this podcast. What will people think when they think of the word Sacramento 20 years from now?
I think the best word, and maybe even 20 years from now, still be the case. But if anything, that's kind of become part of its identity. But burgeoning, like, it seems to always be on the crest of becoming this amazing kind of global phenomenon. But I think that speaks to its positive qualities because it's always changing, right? It's attracting unique people. It's attracting creative people. It's attracting wealthy people in some respect, and I think what'll keep it viable and keep it from becoming just like, oh, it's like San Francisco without the ocean or something like that, which I don't want it to become, if that's not clear, that it's always willing to adapt and change and grow in the respect that its culture can be malleable to the times that's living there, right, to the people that are living there. And I hope that never changes about Sacramento. But I've seen some pretty fascinating growth already and change with what Sacramento is, mostly becoming more involved with local talent and local people. But, I mean, I don't know how much of a presence it is now, but I saw the sort of the rise of Second Saturday, and it took a stumble for a second. I think it's trying to get back to where it was, but a lot of people I know would say it wasn't what it used to be. But that's okay. It's becoming something different. The food scene is growing. Of course, the craft beer scene is exploding, and, you know, thanks for that. It's wonderful. But, and that might someday collapse on itself. But that's okay. I think Sacramento is resilient enough to do something new, to be something new. And 20 years from now, I hope they're saying that Sacramento is something that I can't even define now, right? That it's actually something, it's finding an identity or an edge that is wholly appropriate for 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. When days are tough, so during finals week, students give you 20 emails, are you sure you can't offer any more extra credit? What do you find yourself daydreaming? Oh man, I should have done X with my life instead.
It's during those times where I probably start thinking the most, like, I could probably do comics for a living. I could do that. And then usually towards the end of summer, I do find myself going like, yeah, I think I'm ready to teach again. I can do this. But yeah, that's when I daydream the most about, let's shuck one of these careers I've been doing and go full bore into the other. But, you know, maybe one day I'll take myself up on that. But for now, I'm really enjoying bouncing between the two, mm-hmm. as stressful as they both can get. One definitely more stressful than the other.
Well, what would you tell people that would say, well, if you did shuck the teaching gig, it would force you to do comics 24/7 and thus your rise to success would be a little bit quicker?
What would I tell people?
Yeah.
If I decided to do that?
Yeah.
To be fair, I think most of them would say you can do it. I'm the last person to see that potential usually. And they're like, yeah, finally. I'm like, okay, thank you. But what I tell people is that if I made that decision, I'd probably be sure that I could do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to go at my own pace and say, and make decisions only when I know that, not necessarily that's going to be 100% success. I'm not going to say it's not going to be a risk, but when I have that confidence and that plan to go, okay, actually I can sustain myself or at least move in that direction. And I would tell people, hmm, Again, I don't think I get a lot of pushback. I think I tell people that I'm going. That's the thing I'd go around saying, like, "Well, did you know I'm doing this?" And they probably say, "Good," right? And I'm like, "Thanks," and they'd say, "Go do it." I guess. Obviously, dialogue is not my forte here when it comes to writing. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I that's what I tell people. If there's any pushback, it would be, "Are you sure you're ready to do this?" Because they know how reticent I can be, and I would say, "Yes, I'm ready to do this." Mm-hmm. So. That'd be the conversation, most likely.
What do you want the final chapter of D. Bethel to look like? So ultimately, when you're done mm-hmm. with whatever D. Bethel is, mm-hmm. what does that look like?
A guy that feels he's contributed in some way, whether it's through teaching, whether it's through storytelling. Whatnot, a guy that feels that that he said what he needed to say and people have listened. That's a bit abstract, but I think that's what I'm aiming for. That mm-hmm. I've actually, that going back to that little kid who was told to not go outside or was scared to go outside, going like, okay, I actually have accomplished that mission of being, yeah, people think I'm okay, right? Even though he was weird and kept to himself and quiet, he actually made people's lives, if not better, at least contributed to them in some shape or form, mm-hmm. hopefully in a positive way.
Why haven't you made that comic yet?
It's there. I think, well, I don't know if there's going to be one comic to do that, you know? Every story is going to be a little piece in some way. I don't think I frankly don't think I have the talent to do that great American comic or the great American novel, but it's the body of work that will speak, right? And will be the gestalt that makes this thing called the D. Bethel oeuvre, mm-hmm. to be pretentious about it. But yeah, that's Long John is saying something apparently about me. Thanks for bringing that up. And there, I know there are other stories that are more personal that I'm going to tell, or at least want to tell, and those will definitely, in theory, for me, be that a larger step in that direction than maybe something that Evan 07 or Long John will ever do. So, mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself a success?
Yes, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. I made a lot of bad choices. I was never a bad kid, but the flunking out and always having that self-doubt kind of problem did for a while make me very regretful. But for me, and I come across a lot of students that have this, they're in the same position. They feel like, I haven't made the wrong choice to come to college because I'm not doing well, stuff like that. Or they made bad choices in school to make their grades suffer and perhaps their future suffer. And the first question I always ask is, do you like yourself? Do you think you're a good person? Then every choice you made is a good one. And when I realized that specific sort of life lesson was during that time when I'd flunked out of school, I had hair down to my ass and I was wearing lots of more flannel than I am now. And, trying to either with my music, I want to be Neil Young when I grow up, or I want to be Jim Lee as a comic artist, or I want to be Michael Chabon as a writer. But I'm like, no, I would like myself ultimately. So that's good enough for me. I don't have many regrets because mm-hmm. of it.
Mm-hmm. One lesson you've learned since starting Long John that you wish you would have learned at the beginning that would have made your life easier.
Don't be afraid to put yourself out there. Don't be afraid to reach out to people. Again, going back to the sort of self-doubt thing, there's the sort of original ethic I was going into with regards to, publicity and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to make the best comic I can do, and then the people will find it. And that has worked to an extent, but if I don't put myself out there, I will guarantee that fewer people will find it. And so just within the last year or so, I'm like, yeah, just getting that burst of confidence and having some projects going on behind the scenes that are really motivating me to be like, yeah, no, I am good enough. This comic is good enough. Let's actually put yourself, let's actually make, force myself to get out of my comfort zone even more. In this case, talking with people and sharing it and saying, you should read it, instead of just saying what I said up until that point of going, it's out there, read it if you want, I don't care. You know? That's the biggest lesson, just trying to, and it's something I'm still working on. This is kind of one of the first steps I've taken in that regard. So thank you for allowing me to grow.
No problem. One thing that I find fascinating about the internet is once something is on the internet, hypothetically, it's on the internet forever. So someone could be listening to this 20 years from now. So is there anything that you would like to say to yourself 20 years from now?
I knew that question would come, and I was still not prepared. Getting into character. Not character. I hope you still care, right? I think for as punishing a job as comics can be, and any creative, a lot of creative endeavors where you're mostly by yourself, and teaching is the same problem, even though you're not by yourself, but the idea of getting jaded, of getting discouraged. I saw that happen to my dad as a teacher before he retired, where he, like, and this happened to my mom when, before she retired. My mom has a better story. She realized it was time to retire because she liked the inmates more than her coworkers. I'm like, yeah, that's probably a good time to get out, Mom. And my dad was just realizing that he was making jokes, for example, or making references or trying to up the energy in the classroom. And it was just, he was just confronting glazed eyes. And I'm not saying that's inevitable, but I think part of it was, I think some of the passion for it had gone. And same thing with my mom. And I am so in love with teaching and with making my stuff that I hope that I still care about it in 20 years. And if not, stop it, get back to work. Right.
Anything else that we did not talk about that you wanted to talk about?
I don't think so. I think that was all robust and comprehensive.
What'd you do for a year in Missoula while your girlfriend was,
I was getting my undergrad at that point. Mm-hmm. So I was actually finishing up.
That's a big bummer.
Yeah. But I visited. I love Missoula. It was very nice. The alcohol situation was interesting. It's like you have to go to state run liquor stores and stuff like that. That was cool. Like, I feel so dangerous going in here. I guess one thing, never mind. That's a stupid joke. Mm-hmm. Never mind. So, yeah, no, I think that was pretty comprehensive.
Okay. Where can people find you?
Find me all over the place. dbethel.com, just one word, dbethel.com will get you to my blog that I post everything at. But you can go to longjohncomic.com. You can find me at dbethel, one word, on Twitter. Or you can go, if you're into nerdy stuff, nerdy conversation, go to forallintents.net. Check out the website and the articles you write on there. And those are the best places to go.
And make sure to follow those hyperlinks, because there is another Dan Bethel in this area.
Yes, there is.
He's a little off.
He reached out to me once. He's like, hey, I thought we should become friends. I'm like, I've seen your stuff. Nah, I'm good.
Yeah. All right.
I do not work on hot rods.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Hey y'all, a couple of things before you take off. First, if you want to make sure to get a new episode of Finding Sacramento each week, be sure to subscribe to the podcast through whatever listening platform you're using to listen to the show, whether that be iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or one of the other million podcast apps. And while you're there, go ahead and rate it and let me and others know what you think of the show. According to random computer equations that I don't understand, that apparently lets other people find the show. And as a bonus, if you send me a screenshot of you rating the show to findingsacramento@gmail.com, I will send you a Finding Sacramento bumper sticker. That's right, free swag. Second, if you're into being social with your screens, be sure to follow Finding Sacramento on all of the various social media platforms. For example, if you ever wondered why I can't seem to lose weight, follow me on Instagram at Finding Sacramento. Or if you want a little surprise in your Facebook newsfeed that isn't your parents' political values, then like the Finding Sacramento Facebook page at facebook.com facebook.com/findingsacramento. Third, if you have suggestions for future guests on the show or want to be a guest yourself, shoot me an email at findingsacramento@gmail.com. And finally, if you like the show, tell your friends. And if you don't like the show, well, as they say in the South, oh, bless your heart.